We know they're awful, but they're our awful. I say change the channel and let's take our medicine.
Yeah!
This is the Extra Hot Crate Podcast, episode 309 for the week of June 29th, 2020. I am Helpful Elf David T. Cole, and I'm here with Maritime Explosion Sarah D. Bunting.
The elves went too far!
Stuffed Unitard Tara Ariano.
Yeah, yeah, bing bong!
And Motorized Viking Costume Mark Blankenship.
My shoulder pads are on fire!
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. That sound you heard up top just now was, of course, the sound of a butt returning to the Blankenship chair. It is Mark Blankenship. Hello, Mark!
Mark!
Well, both my butt and I are thrilled to be here today. One of us is more thrilled than the other.
Probably a less insulting way to put it, but I knew you would take it amiss. We are here to talk about Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga. And of course, who better to have on to talk about it than Mark, the person we know, I think, that is the biggest Eurovision expert. He even gave us homework of several performances to watch in preparation for the movie, which we will include in the show notes, the four most essential previous real Eurovision performances that we needed to check out first. But the movie, it's a Netflix original. It stars Will Ferrell as Lars and Rachel McAdams as Sigrid. They are two Icelandic neighbors who have grown up together. They are now in their, I guess, we're supposed to think they're in their 30s. No, they're kids in the 70s, so I guess they're supposed to be our age or older. They gig out at a pub on the weekends, but Lars's dream is of getting into the Eurovision Song Contest. So through a series of lucky breaks and crazy catastrophes, they end up first winning the Iceland Song Contest and then getting to Eurovision.
They get King Ralphed into the...
They do. There's someone in the Iceland power structure. Sure seems like he's trying to tank the contest and make sure the worst act gets through so that they lose. And then as a side story, there's also Sigrid's unrequited love for the very single-minded Lars, who sings oblivious to her affections and keeps saying he thinks they're probably not brother and sister, but he's not sure. So let us start our discussion with Mark. The movie was seeded with Eurovision lore, like how the UK always stinks it up. Victor, of course, who I mentioned in my intro, trying to tank it to avoid the expense of having to host the contest next year. Tons of cameos from past contest winners. Seems like there was some thought put into making this a fun experience for specifically you, Mark Blankenship, yeah, but also people who know and love Eurovision. Did this take feel affectionate to you?
Oh, it absolutely did. And I, having already, as you mentioned, pulled four real Eurovision clips for you all to watch as homework, was especially delighted that I had accidentally picked really on-point clips.
There are no accidents, as you always say.
But it just made me feel like, okay, so whatever it is in the Eurovision culture that vibrates on my frequency apparently vibrated on the frequency of these filmmakers. And I should say, for those of you who are wondering about my Eurovision bona fides, and I'm sure there are tens of you, I, like most Americans, wasn't able to start watching Eurovision until 4 or 5 years ago when they were on Logo. And now they're going to be on Netflix if coronavirus providing they're allowed to ever come back. But so I've seen them, a lot of the performances that have, I've seen all the performances that were available to Americans, but I've also been to the ABBA Museum in Stockholm, Sweden. And I was there when they had a floor dedicated to Eurovision. And my husband, Andrew, and I stayed in that exhibit for so long that one of the museum staff was startled. And that was, and I have now on both of my trips to the ABBA Museum startled a member of the museum staff, but that was how we did it that time.
By so, becoming one of them.
Well, there's also this exhibit where you can step into an ABBA hologram and sing along to Mamma Mia. And I did a monologue in the middle during the instrumental break, and the entire staff apparently was, I guess, befuddled but amused. But I went with it. Anyway, so for me, the things about this movie that I knew I wasn't going to like, I still did not like, including Will Ferrell as an actor. Will Ferrell's bug-eyed inability to ever seem sincere about anything, even when the script so clearly calls for it. That said, the Eurovision passion of the movie really worked for me. And one of the things that I think is so important about the experience of Eurovision is that for all of the self-mocking, tongue-in-cheek kitsch, everyone also seems to really mean it. And there was a lot of that ridiculous earnestness in the way that they dealt with the performances of the numbers, particularly in the, what was it called? The song along, the sound around. But in the section where lots of former Eurovision winners sing directly to the camera, a medley of songs by Madonna, Cher, etc., there was so much like almost like gentle earnestness about it. And I just thought that that was captured quite well.
Well, since you've led us here and since we have Mark and Sarah, let's talk about songs because ding dong, it's still in my head. What did we think of the music?
I think that they were smart to lean as much on the music as they did because I have some of the same issues with a Will Ferrell project of this type is something that will have a strike against it for me just because of what Mark mentioned, that like Will Ferrell is, I don't know, very self-consciously being Will Ferrell all the time. I didn't think it was as bad here, but first of all, Rachel McAdams is so sweet and winning in this that it sort of makes up for the times when Will Ferrell is Will Ferrelling. But I also thought the songs were, I mean, they were just like right on for Eurovision product based on the performances that Mark provided for us as homework, namely that they're like, they're going around and around the circle through bad and back to good and through bad and back to good. They're like very like Bjork in Vegas residency. And I was an hour and a quarter into this thing before I realized that that was fucking Matthew Crawley as the presumptive winner.
Really?
Alexander. And so that I just like kept marveling at that for the rest of the time. But I don't know, music wise, like Mark can speak more to whether that was like on brand for Eurovision. But I think as a movie and a love letter to the experience of Eurovision, I thought that it was well proportioned and that the songs were like, you know, great without actually being good, which is worthwhile, I think.
Yes. I thought that the songs really were the source of my greatest joy. For instance, in the song along medley, they have the French song that Celine Dion sang when she won while she was singing for Switzerland. And that's just like a deep cut. And it also gets at how insane Eurovision is because she's French Canadian and she sang the Swiss entry. I mean, okay, fine. Also, like Israel's not in Europe and Australia's not in Europe, but they get to compete in the Eurovision Song Contest. Okay, fine. But the song that for me really epitomized why the music in this movie got it right was this little quick hit of a song that you hear called Hit My Itch. I don't know if you remember this song. But there is this wonderful thing that happens in Eurovision every year where a lot of people who do not speak English as a first language try to write songs that have slangy English in them. And you get phrases like hit my itch, which don't actually make sense, but they're sung with such fervor that you're like, okay. For instance, there is a song from a few years ago. I believe that it was the contestant from Azerbaijan. She had a song called What's the Pressure? And you're like, okay, what's the pressure? So again, Andrew and I now constantly say to each other, well, I guess we could go, what's the pressure?
I saw a recent American citizen, might have been on Reddit, but he was trying to use the phrase, you bet your ass, but he kept on saying, bet my ass, which is very endearing, same sort of, same spirit.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, the one that for me that was like that was Coolin' with the Homies, that I think we later find out is from Sweden, which it makes it seem like, oh, the mid-90s just got to Sweden. That's good for them.
Yeah,
I liked Mita, who is sort of a secondary character. She's like the friend of the Dan Stevens character, Lemtov. She's the Greek performer, and her whole thing is like a very tattoo-y, male-gazy, like, commodified, fakey lesbian vibe. Yes. I also thought was very, like, locked in time of, you know, 15 years ago, that's what we were doing. But it's still happening at Eurovision. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, before I watch this, in terms of the songs, an Australian critic that I follow on Twitter, Cam Williams, Mr. Cam W, if you want to follow him, suggested another way this could have gone, which was if it had been made by the Lonely Island. And since Popstar is...
I was thinking that.
As I've said, I'm sure, on this podcast, one of my favorite music movies ever, it was hard not to have that in my mind as like a palimpsest on top of this. Because generally, I think I agree with Sarah, this was like a more subdued Will Ferrell in terms of like the Ferrell spectrum.
but still a man-child.
Well, that's the thing. Like, he's not an actor, I think we can all agree, who like... disappears into a role usually. But what you would trade off probably is like, I don't know if a Lonely Island take on the songs would have been as straight faced.
Right.
They would have done a comedy version of the songs and that would have taken away from
actually,
it.
I was thinking watching it the other way, which is like, maybe this could have been better if it was more earnest and less sort of Will Ferrellian zany at times. Like,
okay.
I enjoyed the stuff with the elves.
Oh my god, that little door slamming. I laughed for 10 minutes.
That was like a different movie, right? Like that little part of the movie was from something else that they really wanted to do.
Dave, I completely agree with you. I felt like that the place where the movie felt turgid was when it was trying to make fun of Iceland, because I don't think that the filmmakers understand Icelandic culture the way that they understand Eurovision culture. And I've only been to Iceland 3 times in my life, right? But, like, I've spent some time there. I made a documentary film about the theater in Iceland one time. So, okay. And it's just, like, the Iceland stuff felt off to me. It felt bloated. It's, like, just because you can Wikipedia that there's this idea of elves in Iceland doesn't mean that you understand how they function in the culture. And I just felt like somehow also that they were shoplifting in old jokes from Elf into that portion of the movie, like when the whales come up. And if the whole movie, I kept wishing that that part had just been cut out and that we could just live inside the part of the world that this movie seemed to clearly love and understand.
Yeah, agree. And like, yeah, I mean, the love story, really? Like, whose note was that? Because no.
Yeah, I didn't need that either. But the part of it that I thought got Iceland right was at the end when Sigrid has mentioned a couple of times that she really wishes that she could sing in Icelandic.
Yes.
And he's said, no, you can't. We'll never win. And then at the end, they decide to just, you know, throw away their shot and just sing the song that really comes from the heart. And she sings the chorus in Icelandic, and the reaction that it gets from like all of their friends back home watching in the pub and the watch party at the TV network or whatever that is supposed to be, of like how excited they are to hear her singing in Icelandic. Like, I thought that was really sweet. That part really got me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And I think it's partially because that moment rested on Rachel McAdams, who is so good at embodying this sort of, she comes across as innocent and guileless without seeming to make fun of herself, which I thought was really lovely to watch.
Yeah.
I just feel like we should note that there's an 11-year age difference between Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams, and yet they're supposed to be contemporaries.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably an 11-year age difference between Will Ferrell and fucking Pierce Brosnan, who plays his dad, but it's like, I don't know what elfin magic is happening with like this world, but who cares? Like, Pierce Brosnan being like the disappointed fisherman dad was so random.
Yes.
It came back around to perfect, I felt.
Yeah. I was willing to grant that Rachel McAdams just looked that great because she eats a lot of Siggy's yogurt and, you know, that's the secret of her amazing skin.
And that stinky fish they stick underground for a year or whatever.
The rotted shark, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we should circle back to good old Matthew Crawley, Dan Stevens, and why he's not always doing comedy because he's so funny. I mean.
Oh my God, he was so funny.
From the hair to the shirt, like ripping off the whatever the liner is. Oh. He's shirtless under his jacket. I mean,
yes.
He and Jamie Demetrio and Natasia Demetrio, Stadlet's Flats reunion. I loved them. Kevin Swain. I thought he was very, very funny.
Our friend Joe Reed tweeted today that Dan Stevens is already the Oscar winner for Best Supporting Actor, and I cannot disagree with that.
I wish I thought he would win, but that. Yeah. I hope they're in the running for costume design at least for this, because... Wow, there were some amazing
things.
And
what if that last song was an Oscar nominee and got to be performed? Weirder things have happened.
Yeah, one of the funny sequel ideas I saw was if another crazy set of lucky chances and coincidences / catastrophes leads to Lars and Sigrid performing the halftime show at the Super Bowl. It should be another really funny place to take these characters if someone felt there was another place they needed to go. Yeah, I would call this movie a C+, but it has to be said, I cried 3 times in the course of it. It was just so nice to see the world. Like, I kind of forgot that it's out there. In the song-along scene, I found, even though it was so super corny, I found it weirdly moving. Like, I'm just watching it,
too.
It was like... Remember fun? Like, you know, the Icelandic singing sequence, the chorus, that was another one. And including at the end when the credits come up and they show everyone's names with their flags beside
the flags.
Them. It's like international love. I was really touched by that. So, yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I don't know why, but it got me really emotional, too. The
really?
Flags coming up.
I'm glad
up.
It
yeah.
wasn't just me.
It was just like such a sweet gesture. And it just, I don't know why, but it really made me cry that it was like, look at all these people coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cute. I mean, this also isn't something that I would watch normally, but yeah, I don't know why, but it just like hit me. But things have been hitting me really weirdly like that. Like I fucking cried at a Below Deck Med the other day. Like, I mean, some of this is not on the Fire Saga.
Sure.
But on the other hand, some of it is like Rachel McAdams in particular just gives such a nice straight down the middle performance and isn't like cheating and trying to get laughs like that scene where she's trying to write the song.
Yeah,
is really good. There are really good bits in here. I thought it was good.
Dave thinks we're all ridiculous.
No, that's fine. You know, guys, I live for self-isolation pre, post, during coronavirus. This is totally my jam. As far as social distancing, etc., goes. So.
I do too normally. That's why I was really surprised by my reaction to like this of all things, you know.
This movie was definitely the type of movie that I always expect Netflix ends up with, which is like studio pass to kind of see like this is going to be a C+ movie at best, and like they were right.
Yeah.
And Netflix just is like, yeah, sure, we'll take it. You know, like that'll check some boxes for us. You know, we need something for Netflix Australia and Netflix Latvia or whatever, you know. And this will play to them. And it doesn't really matter if it's good or bad. It's just a matter of how many people will keep their subscription because we're putting out stuff like this. And that's the weird math of the Netflix world. Just sort of exists in this weird Netflix pocket universe where it can succeed because it is doing A, B, and C for their market or markets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a fun little ride. But I was sort of interested in just like the weirdness of Eurovision. Like I would never watch probably Eurovision just because I'm not into music in the way everybody else on the panel is. But the idea that there's been this European Union song contest going on since the 50s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
A continent rises from the ashes of war, and one of the first things they decide to do together to heal the wound. Music contest. Where all
is getting a pop music fight with each other.
But I kind of wish that they could take Will Ferrell out of the movie and take that element out of the movie and see what they would have got with that. Still a comedy or like a light comedy. But I feel like that stole some of the magic away from
it. You know who they should have cast instead that would have been more on point? Alexander Skarsgård.
Yeah, or just somebody who can play it. Like, honestly, like Colin Farrell would have been good.
Yeah,
he would have.
If you need a Farrell.
Would have made a more realistic son for Pierce Brosnan, too.
True.
Hello.
True. Mark, you, it sounded like you had one last question before we close it up.
Yes, my last question is, I wondered if you'd had an opportunity to watch the pre-screening homework video of the Occidentale's Karma performance.
Of course.
I just wondered how you felt when the giant gorilla in a bow tie showed up.
Okay, so I almost said something when... So we should say first, well, these will all be in the show notes. The clips that Mark gave us were Occidentale's Karma, Conchita Wurst, Rise Like a Phoenix, Netta's Toy, and Lordi's Hard Rock Hallelujah. So the first of these is just an Italian guy singing a song. There's like projections behind him of like, you know, silhouettes dancing and stuff. And I was about to say, like, why do these look like chimps? And then all of a sudden here was a guy, I assume, in a gorilla suit with a bow tie, like dancing next to him. It was
in a gorilla suit that was like the gorilla suit from
a little the worse for wear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know that, like, this is a deep cut, but that, like, weird electronic surplus store on Queen Street West in Toronto where for years and years there's just, like, a gorilla suit left out in the rain in front of the store, chained to the door.
And snow. Yes. Snow.
Uh-huh. It was kind of like that. Or, the end of, is it Trading Places? At the end of Trading Places, there's a gorilla in the train?
It might be at the beginning.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was like that caliber.
And the choreography is very basic that they do with the gorilla.
Well, look, once you introduce a dancing gorilla to a song about karma, like, you don't really need to do a lot with it. It's more like just that happened rather than the execution of that happening. So, they knew they only had to do so much.
I mean, the lyrics, too. Namaste. Allez. Oh, God. All right, Spice Boy.
Oh, God. I'm just grateful that you've seen it.
Yeah. Thank you for the grounding. I mean...
Well, here's an idea for Eurovision, because they always have to, like, up themselves, right? You know, bigger production, bigger stages, more lasers, more, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. In round one or however they do it, there's one round where everybody has to incorporate the one element. So this, you know, it would have been like, everybody's got to have a dancing primate in their stage show. Away you go. So even if you're doing like a love song or you're doing some like tragic, like you're doing some like Gordon Lightfoot-esque, you know, Wreck of the Edmonds Fitzgerald, you still got to have a dancing monkey out there doing something.
I like the idea too that it could, you said primate. So like, Azerbaijan chose a gibbon. What an interesting choice.
We are going around the dial talking about things we've seen on television recently. Tara Ariano.
Hey, everyone. Do you remember Search Party? Search Party was a show. It was on TBS for 2 seasons. Originally, the premise of the show was there's this girl named Dory. She's played by Alia Shawkat. She's underemployed and bored in her weird, you know, gig economy jobs, bored in her relationship. She's walking down the street one day and sees a flyer for a missing girl and realizes it's someone that she knows from school. And she becomes obsessed and decides she's going to try and find this missing girl. And then the first season is sort of about that, her and her friends, who also some of them kind of know this girl as well. And then it completely kind of really goes off the rails in season 2. And then it was off the air for almost 3 years. Season 2 aired in November of 2017. And whoa. I know I watched it. I have only the vaguest recollection of what happened. Given the time lag, a meaty recap of the kind that Netflix sometimes does when a show comes back for a new season would have been a good idea before season 3 dropped last week on HBO Max. Because I was like... Okay, I mean, sure, I watched this show.
Was it like a new season they recently done, or did they film a season? It was sitting on the shelves and they decided, oh, boy,
they shot it in 2018.
Up there. Yeah.
Yes, it's been sitting around for a while. So there's a lot of like product coming to HBO Max that's been like just around. There's actually a show from the person that did Regular Show.
Uh-huh.
They have a new show coming out next week called Close Enough. Mm-hmm. That's like, oh, it's the same thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where it's like, the episodes are like 22 minutes, but they're clearly like two episodes stuck together. We have screeners, so we can watch that next week. Side note. Anyway, that's another one that, like, it was supposed to be on TBS, and then it was in limbo because one of its producers was Louis C.K. Awkward. Mm. Anyway, digression.
Yeah.
Back to Search Party. As I said, I watched it. So I was like, okay, well, here it is. I guess I'll check it out. I watched the first two, got partway through the third to where the four leads are in a car. One of them is shrieking, and I suddenly was like, okay, enough. I don't need to watch this. Like, I barely remember what the fuck happened when I last saw these people. Like, I love John Early, who is one of the stars. I saw him interviewed about the show on Seth Meyers last week. And he was saying that the show is supposed to be a satire of media portrayals of white millennial obliviousness and privilege, which, like, this is too many levels of abstraction, or I'm too dumb to get it, or I don't care anymore because it's been 3 years since I last saw it.
Or you just don't like shrieking.
Or I just... it was like that. And plus, in a car, it's like I felt like I was in the car with them. It's like, I don't need this in my life. Anyway, I've heard from someone who guessed which show I quit partway through the third episode of its third season. Like, no, you made the right choice. I've continued to watch and it's not good. But I'm no longer deriving any enjoyment out of these characters screeching at me. So goodbye. Sorry. And by the way, I remember the first season like being a good self-contained idea that's like, just watch the first season and stop. And by the way, show, make one season and stop. I know we keep saying this, but sometimes it's really true. That could be enough. The end.
They drove a dump truck full of money to my front door.
How much of a dump truck could this thing cost?
TBS.
It looks like it cost.
TBS, seriously.
That TBS money.
Like,
they gave me a handful of coupons for Wendy's.
I mean, anyway, so let's wash the unpleasant taste of Search Party over and move on to Hot Mess House.
Great title.
Yeah. Well, so this is an organizing show, which, you know, I can't resist. It's on HGTV on Wednesday nights. So I was dubious about this one because it's a self-shot show, which means the people getting organized, they're shooting their half themselves. And then the organizer is shooting her half, and then they're talking to each other on like Skype or Zoom or whatever the hell.
It's a Corona show.
It's a Corona show. So I guess I have to get used to this. See, Amy Schumer Learns to Cook just got renewed for season two. So the organizer's name is Kaz Arzen. Apparently, Mark just interviewed her. He told us before we started recording today.
I did. She's quite lovely. I wrote a piece about HGTV's slate of self-shot shows for Primetimer.
Of course. Is she Canadian? Because she sounds Canadian.
She sure is.
All right. Her gimmick is the idea is that different people who have organizing challenges or organizing styles are, she calls them clutter bugs, and you're either a cricket, a bee, a ladybug, or a butterfly.
Oh, God.
And she has a quiz on her website, which you can take. I'll put it in the show notes. I took the quiz, even though I generally don't have an organization problem, although papers are my downfall. Turns out I am a cricket, which means, and I quote, I love visual simplicity.
Yeah.
And organizational abundance.
Yeah.
I prefer my everyday items out of sight.
Uh-huh.
But I am a bit of a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And a very detail organized person.
I mean, otherwise known as I want to live in a clinic. Like, that is basically it.
I want to live in a morgue with everything white and I can just hose it all down. Yeah. Drag me, Kaz Arzen, was my note after I got this result back. Anyway.
What were the insects again? Cricket?
Cricket, bee, butterfly, and ladybug. So bee, okay, well, I'll get back to it. Okay. So enough about me, onto the show. It premiered with two episodes back-to-back. From now on, it's only one a week. In the first episode, we have a family with a finished basement that is clearly fully a dumping ground, which infuriated me because that's just wasted space you could be doing literally anything with. And then also a couple who've just moved in together into a very small apartment. They both have tons of clothes and a walk-in storage closet that they've also just been dumping shit in. So the closet for them is clearly the smaller project, goes fine. Kaz tells them to get rid of half their clothes. I'm not sure that they do, but they get everything to fit into the spaces they have, so it's fine. But it does point up the problem with the format, which is you're going to be limited in how much you can get done if the organizing expert is not on site and able to like physically pick up some dumb piece of crap in your house and go, you really need this, and basically like shame you into getting rid of it, which is like most of what these shows are, I feel like.
Or the classic, you pick up something that's actually like a Russian nesting doll of hoarding, you know,
right.
Like there's,
it's like a box with a box with another box in it.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The bigger issue in the first episode is this basement, which they do whip into shape. They turn it into a home gym and a home office area. But I can predict it's just going to slide into chaos again, because the mother has two of the markers of chaos that I recognize from watching Hoarders. Sarah, you will recognize these as well. Number one, she goes to garage sales.
Oh, huh.
Number two, she calls herself a crafter, which actually means she buys a lot of materials and tools that just take up space and probably rarely get used. So Kaz diagnoses this woman as a B, Dave, which means her problem is she needs to have all her stuff out where she can see it, or she forgets about it or can't find it again. So she gets her this amazing crafting desk with like built-in shelves and cubbies. This thing like folds up into a cabinet when she's not using it. This just means the mess is going to like start spilling out onto the footprint of the floor that isn't taken up where the desk is when she's not using it, when this cabinet's closed up, is my prediction.
I think I am kind of B-ish, though.
No kidding.
Although I don't understand why it's called the B, what it is about a B that they need to... I don't understand that part of it, but...
Maybe carrying pollen around?
Could be.
Scattering it?
Yeah. Because there's a person in the second episode who has the same thing, and she's like, she shows how she walks through the house, and she's like, here's my smoothie station, and it's like everything is set up because she uses it every day. It's like your coffee station beside your Keurig.
I would say the insect for that, if you have to have all your shit where you can see it, would be a dung beetle.
Right. Nobody's going to get on board with that, though.
I don't know. I think it would move t-shirts.
All of these categories sound like the name of your second grade reading groups.
Yes, like, totally.
I'm a B. We're reading Babysitter's Club.
So the second episode is not as good. The main project involves a family cleaning up their ungrateful daughter's playroom. These girls are getting older. Kaz tells them to get rid of half their dolls. The oldest girl, who looks to me like she's about 13, starts crying. The mother blames herself for making the kids like get so much invested in their things. And then the parents end up doing the whole playroom makeover themselves as a gift to the girls. Like, they're the ones who messed it up. Make them clean it. But the older girl truly never recovers and is still moping days later from having to get rid of the dolls. And when they do the room reveal, she's still like so sad, and they just never acknowledge that she hates it and is still upset, and they just don't talk to her, yeah. Which is kind of funny.
Wow.
I mean, I'm sorry, but like, you're 13, like, get rid of half your dolls.
You're not gonna make that edit. You're not gonna make the edit like that, kid.
Anyway, the show's fine as far as it goes. The lack of contact between Kaz and the people that she's helping, I think, really lessens the impact of the process. And it might just be a show that I put on to see the horrifying befores, to judge them, do whatever for 28 minutes, and then look up again for the afters. And also, like, since Kaz's whole thing is this clutterbug gimmick, I don't know why the show is not called Clutterbugs rather than Hot Mess House. This seems obvious to me. What were you going to say, Dave?
Clutterbugs, I bet, has been trademarked by somebody.
Yeah,
that's
probably.
Pretty punny thing.
Yeah.
I just want to say, Mark, just talking about reading groups and everything like that.
Yeah.
Apropos of nothing about TV, total recall about the McCall reading book series from school.
Sure.
You know, where like...
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You get the kids, they're still in the blue books, and you're at red, and they're dumb, and you're better. McCall!
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, great meme,
I'm sorry.
Ever so good.
Jeez.
I actually said with complete seriousness once to my parents when I was maybe in second grade, I am too old to read any book that is less than 75 pages long.
All right. So those are my shows. For my plug, I don't have anything this week that is new. We'll have a couple of things next week. But instead, I'm going to plug our past guest, Stephanie Green, because the story that she mentioned, 14 Meals, is up on the New Ohio Review. So I will have a link directly to that. You can either read it, or you can listen to her reading it to you in our show notes.
Mr. Mark Blankenship in the Blankenship Chair. What do you got?
Oh, God. Just pleased to be sitting here again. And it's got a place for my drink. So... Penny Dreadful is a show that John Logan created for Showtime that came on a few years ago. It had 3 seasons. It's really wonderful, over-the-top trash. And, of course, I was very excited, therefore, when I saw that Penny Dreadful City of Angels was returning. And this updates the premise of Penny Dreadful in the sense that it tells a very genre-heavy story, but now it's in 1938 in Los Angeles. And instead of a variety of monsters, it's a variety of monsters, but more of them are human. So in this one season in Los Angeles, you've got the intersection of Nazism, religious zealotry, and for no reason that anyone ever even tries to explain, you have Natalie Dormer, of all people, playing the embodiment of a Mexican demon. And she plays multiple characters with a variety of accents. And they all sort of infiltrate Los Angeles to sow destruction.
You forgot about the most evil element of this show, which is the highway.
Oh gosh, you're right. So not unlike Who Framed Roger Rabbit, yep. The big plot arc of the whole season is about one of the guys from Mad Men now is a closeted gay crazy politician who is going to build a highway to box off all of the communities of color in Los Angeles so that he can have his like Aryan power base in the middle of the city. And you know, okay, I feel like as social critique, maybe the less said the better about Penny Dreadful City of Angels. I'm not going to front either, like, Natalie Dormer's accent work is great. Like, I don't think a real German would ever hear her and be like, oh, yeah, she seems like she's from Munich. Because homegirl is like, roll in the hay. Oh, yeah, I'd love to drink a stein of beer. Don't you want to? I am a demon. Anyway. But there are things about the show that make it wonderful. And the number one thing is this child actor named Santino Bernard plays Frank, who is a child that Natalie Dormer's demon character literally pulls out of her body, and now he is her, like, fake German child, because there's this whole subplot where German demon is trying to seduce the head of the Aryan nation in Los Angeles, played by Rory Kinnear, and he is trying to be, like, a good Nazi, and he doesn't want to... I realize how this sounds, but he doesn't want to go completely with Hitler. He wants to help support people who have different ideas, but she's decided that she can get power through him. And so she and her demon child go and, like, they convince him to put his wife, played by Piper Perabo, into an insane asylum. So then German demon and demon child move in, and then German demon child starts bunking up with oldest child of Nazi doctor. Okay. So all of this is just foreshadowing to the fact that the kid who plays Frank the Demon Child, Santino Bernard, plays him as a queenie. He's just like a campy queenie villain, and he is so good on this show. It's like one of the greatest, most insane child performances I've ever seen. And there is a moment near the end of the season when he is lying in bed in his little striped pajamas next to his now adopted brother, and he's like, brothers love each other, don't they? And we're brothers now, so you have to love me. And then the little boy's like, okay. And then, just to prove his point, Demon Child looks over and gives side eye to the pet hamster in the room, and the hamster immediately dies. So this Demon Child kills a hamster with side eye, and if that is not a gay goal for me and all of my queer brothers and sisters, I do not know what is. I have never felt more seen and yet felt more aspiration toward a life than when I saw a hamster die via side eye. So there, an imperfect show, but Frank is a joy and a dream.
I am impressed you made it to the end of the season. I got one episode in, and I was like, I can't do it.
I mean, I'm not going to pretend like it's great. You know, like, I own what it is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the difference for me, like, the original Penny Dreadful was just such a greatest hits, you know, rogue gallery kind of show. And this one just seemed actually sort of anemic by comparison.
Yes. The reason that I love Frank is that he is the only part of the show that harkens back to what I loved about the first Penny Dreadful, which is the sense of fun.
Yeah.
And I think that Penny Dreadful City of Angels is it's trying too hard to make big statements when really more gay demon children should be killing things with cyanide.
You know what's maybe a better heir to Penny Dreadful, which we started watching this weekend?
Yeah.
Doom Patrol, which also stars Timothy Dalton.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that next week because we're not
After we finish the season.
But yeah. I feel like a lot of things Mark's talking about is sort of deliberate and done well in Doom Patrol.
Well, we'll put a pin in that.
Rather than just sort of stumbling upon a good moment now and then, which is my sense of Penny Dreadful City.
More to come.
So what network or streaming service is Doom Patrol on?
Well, it was on DC Universe, which was the DC-only streaming channel, which, you know, you have to really be into DC Comics to want to pony up for that. But since HBO Max has come into existence, they seem to be now slowly moving all that into HBO Max, and it probably DC Universe will just become a sort of phantom brand, I would imagine. And if you get HBO Max, eventually you'll be getting the DC stuff.
Yeah, so DC. So season one is there. Season two episodes have started already. Like, they're already there. So I don't. I assume they're on DC Universe as well. And apparently Harley Quinn is another one that people really like, the animated show. So that's all that is coming.
Obviously,
to
we
HBO
never
Max.
Had DC Universe. So this is our first opportunity to watch it without going through methods. So that's why we're just catching up on it now. Yeah.
Well, I will track that down.
Yeah.
And I will also plug a publication that I just launched 2 weeks ago called The Flash Paper, which is a print-only journal that allows theater artists to respond in any genre they choose to an urgent question about current events. And the first issue of The Flash Paper features 12 exceptional theater artists responding to the question, what will it be like when social distancing ends? And they've responded with plays, with manifestos. There's a hand-drawn comic strip called Andrew Cuomo's Nipple Rings. There's a photo essay. And some of the contributors, David Henry Hwang, who is a Pulitzer Prize nominee and Tony Award winner, wrote the foreword. Sarah Treem, who created the show The Affair, wrote the afterword. And Pulitzer Prize nominated playwright Claire Barron wrote one of the original plays. And for every single copy of the Flash Paper that is sold, each one of the contributing independent theater artists earns a dollar, and $2.50 goes to an organization called the Indie Theater Fund, which then will re-grant that money to independent theater artists as well. So it is a print publication that gives you lots of cool content to enjoy, and it is a fundraiser for many, many theater artists. And you can find your copy of The Flash Paper at theflashpaper.com.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I have a little true crime wrap up to take us through the next couple of weeks. First, I know that I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is the Michelle McNamara / Golden State Killer series that just dropped on HBO last Sunday. That's getting the bulk of the attention right now. But there are a couple of other projects that I think are just as worth your time and attention, starting with Outcry, which is a 5-part series on Showtime concerning the allegedly wrongful conviction of a high school up-and-coming football player named Greg Kelly. This all happened right outside of Austin. Leander, I think the name of the town is. Mm-hmm. It's really well done. It's extremely suspenseful. I haven't come up with a name for this, but like the ability of a true crime series to hold your attention well enough that you are not second screen Googling the case details and getting out ahead of the filmmaker. Like that anti-Google effect or like Google under the Google dome. I don't know. I'm hearing suggestions. So at Tomato Nation on Twitter, please let me know if you can come up with a term for this. I know I've asked this before. Outcry is extremely good at holding my attention and like that I'm actively wanting to Google and see what's going to happen, but I'm trusting the creator, who is named Pat Condellis and also did a documentary for Showtime a couple years ago called Disgraced, which was about a true crime case involving cheating at Baylor University. So that's really good. I've seen 3 out of 5. All 5 are going to drop on Showtime streaming availabilities on July 5th. Or you can watch it week by week. And I suggest you do so. This was supposed to come out at the end of March, but there's a lot of like true crime properties that for various reasons were considered not appropriate for pandemic times or post George Floyd times, that I think, you know, a meat amount of time was waited. And then the networks were like, well, we got to air something. So the scheduling right now of true crime is very weird and clustery, including the reboot of Unsolved Mysteries, which I am pleased to report is pretty good. Because they did, like, they just took absolutely nothing from the original except two things. One, the incredibly creepy minor chord resolution of the theme song. They kept that. That's like the whole theme, basically. And then they decided not to use a host. I really was like, I think this should have a host. I think Dennis Haysbert would be perfect. I miss the, you know, I'd hate change. I want things to stay the same. But they subtracted the host, they subtracted the segments, but at the end of the credits, there's that like, and then this mist forms, the letters Unsolved Mysteries, and then the shape of Robert Stack's face, and then it dissipates, and talk about weird things making you emotional. I'm watching a screener, and there's like the fond haunting by old Stacky. I was like, hey, buddy. I was just like really happy to see him. And then it's like kind of your, not average, but like your garden variety Netflix anthologized true crime show. It's like a way better Dateline with more swears. And this is the smartest way to do it. Like it's not a groundbreaking thing, but it's well made. They've selected amazing subjects. Episode two involving, okay, this woman disappears, her, you know, widower slash one of the suspects, Rob, is so weird. And he's like unpacking her cremains for the camera. And you could just feel the whole production team, like behind the camera, sort of leaning back and side eyeing each other. Like, what is this guy? As he's talking about how he slept with the box of the cremains, like she was a teddy bear, which is, I mean, it's a lot. I think Rob needs to talk to someone and not a camera.
Sarah, this is not really germane to this, but every time I hear the word cremains, my brain always goes to like something from Ocean Spray, like it's cranberry remains.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even trying to be like, okay, yeah, that's jokey, but like my brain actually does that. Cremains, is that like cranberry? No way,
no.
That is a thing.
Mine goes to Johnny Tremaine, so I get it. I guess I should pronounce it differently, like Jane Mancini says designs, I should say cremains, but then it's then there's
that
cream.
Sounds like something that I would have as a breakfast pastry.
Yes.
Or yeah, that, or like there's a European coffee mate product called like crema or something like
crema,
that. Like,
yeah.
It is very close to cremains.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you say it Uranus or Uranus, you lose either way.
So sorry, cremains and grossed out camera crew.
So this was the smart way to do it because the original does exist. It is available on Amazon Prime. You can visit with Stack anytime you want in his trench coat / dad khakis. So I like, this is from the same production company. It's the same font. There's that same theme music. And then you get a more like updated, like a deeper dive into each case. And then they throw it back to you, the internet, for like, if you have any information on the case, go to unsolved.com. So I think it's kind of perfect for these times where, the Reddit herring detective crew is standing by 24/7 to try to wade into these cases, much as Michelle McNamara did with great success in I'll Be Gone in the Dark. I brought it all back around. So I wrote up Unsolved for Primetimer, and there will be a link to that in the show notes. And as you're listening to this, the new Unsolved Mysteries, there's 12 episodes, I think, in the first season, but they're holding 6 for reasons. I don't know. The first 6 should be up now. And there's only one UFO story. Yay!
Whoa.
So you can watch. Yeah.
next on Extra Extra Hot Great. It is episode 69.
Nice.
Nice.
The nice episode, yes. a rundown of various ways TV is nice, and this is a pretty stupid episode. So look forward to that. Patreon.com/extrahotgreat. Any level of support will get you that and all the other 68 episodes and all the future episodes as long as you are a supporter. On the next two EHG Primes, we have the guest forcing episode where we watch and talk about shows that Stephanie, John, and Richard?
Nope, Stephanie, Dan.
Dan, yes, thank you. Sorry, Dan. And Richard made us watch a good mix of stuff, if you've been paying attention to that. The week after that, we welcome Alana Bennett to discuss Palm Springs, the show, not the town. My review of the town would be hot and expensive.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Dave Lost Wages. He is calling it Welcome Cousin Oliver, and Dave writes, make your pitch to improve a show with the addition of a new family member, in parentheses, adopted cousin, recently divorced uncle, sassy grandparent, to a stale TV family. Who is the new character? Who gets cast? How do they liven up the existing family? What premise will be used to explain their addition in universe? I'll go first. I had a whole answer already about bringing in a conservative cousin on One Day at a Time, and then I watched the animated politics episode, and I do not want that anymore. No. That episode, not good.
No, we didn't talk about it after it aired. But
no,
I don't want to engage with Tara with this because I don't want to spend the next 20 minutes hearing about what a bad cop-out episode.
I'm just saying it was bad. That's all I have to say.
I know.
Do you agree it was bad?
I do agree.
All right,
there was a lot of equal time given to things that should not be given equal time.
100%. Instead, I'm going over to the bold type, and I'm going to have Sutton's mother Babs, who's played by Rhea Kilstead, move to New York. This is slightly a cop out because she has appeared in past episodes. She is not a brand new character that I'm inventing. She has only been a guest star in three previous episodes across four seasons. I feel like that is little enough that she's basically parachuting in. No one really knows that much about her. So Sutton is currently a stylist. She has married a really rich guy, Richard, played by the adorable guy. Oh, no, now I can't remember the actor's name, but he was Christina Hendricks' husband on Mad Men. That guy, super cute.
Yeah,
that
Sam.
Guy. Sam Page. Got it. Thank you, Mark. We got there together. He currently is working on some kind of a startup in San Francisco. It doesn't matter. It's so that they don't have to pay him for every episode. But he's in San Francisco. She's in New York. So she comes from kind of a little more of a hardscrabble background. She's from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They have previously established she grew up with guns. She had a gun in New York for a while. That was a whole like issue episode, except it wasn't like a handgun. She had a shotgun like under her bed in New York.
A Gatling gun by the door.
Almost. She had a bazooka. No, she had a shotgun, like a hunting shotgun. Anyway, she grew up with a single mother who had drinking problems. And so she and her mother, Babs, had, you know, ups and downs. Babs in more recent years has been trying to get her act together. However, as we know, two different sitcoms this year, both of which failed, were about boomer parents who lost all of their money. This very well could happen to Babs, particularly since she's only very lately come to trying to get her act together.
Were either one of those called KO Boomer?
No.
Should have been. Free one for you, Hollywood.
This could happen to Babs, even though, as I said, she didn't have much to start with. And B, she's probably Gen X, which is frankly rude of the show to even make her. But if Sutton is like in her mid-20s, she's probably our age, which like fuck off the bold type. But moving on. As I said, Sutton married a rich guy who lives on the other coast most of the time. Her big empty apartment is perfect for odd couple mother-daughter hijinks and for them to clash about this and that and, you know, her using the expensive face cream on her legs or whatever the hell, and then, you know, getting closer in the process. Yes, Dave.
Beetle and Bee. from the organization
There's
show.
No Beatles.
Oh, what is
Cricket.
It? Cricket. Cricket and the Bee. That's the name of the show.
Okay. It's not a spinoff. Oh, it's just she's adding it.
Right.
But yes, they would have
of the episode.
Cricket and Bee problems, to be sure. Thank you for that addition, Dave. Mark.
Okay. I want you to go with me on this. It's going to feel wrong, but I believe it's right.
Okay.
So, in the upcoming, just announced final season of Ozark, okay, Wendy Bird, as played by Laura Linney, gets an urgent phone call from her long-estranged cousin, Adrian, who has been involved in some sort of sexual scandal with one of the students at his high school where he teaches drama. So Wendy, sensing an opportunity, allows her cousin Adrian, she somehow works it out so that her cousin Adrian gets to open a little summer theater a la Dirty Dancing in the area where he can put on plays, escape his past, offer an opportunity for even more hiding out of drugs, money, whatever, and invite Wendy to tap into her long-suppressed desire to be on stage, meaning that cousin Adrian then uses the theater to create ironic juxtapositions between what's happening in the theater and in the life of the characters. And that cousin Adrian is played by Rick Schroeder.
I was hoping it was going to be Mark Ruffalo.
That was you were going to.
It was, that would be a great idea. I was also thinking about Mark Evan Jackson, but I thought, no, I need it to be someone who is serious and who can play serious in a dark drama, a la Rick Schroeder in NYPD Blue, but will make us think about our halcyon days of youth, a la Rick Schroeder in Silver Spoons. So I just feel like when she gets cast as Viola in Twelfth Night, but she's actually Lady Macbeth, that's going to be a really great arc for her.
Sarah.
Love it. This is probably not the brief, but once I had this idea, it would not leave. Much like that wrong answer to the crossword clue that you absolutely can't get rid of, even though you know it's wrong.
The Wizard of Iz.
Yeah. The Wizard of Id. I don't know. But the Real Housewives of New Jersey have a vacancy to fill now that Juicy Joe has been deported and he and Teresa are separating. And since both Melissa Gorga and Melania, and frankly, a whole bunch of the others, secretly, if not openly, aspire to musical somethinghood, what better time to bring in a producer in the form of an actual, literal cousin Oliver, Robbie Rist, who is a voiceover actor and musician who wrote the theme to Sharknado. Did anyone else know this?
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So, he is age appropriate for Teresa, even though when she's wearing those like 5-inch stripper spikes, she's probably a foot taller than him, but that's all right. So yeah, that's my idea. Like actual cousin Oliver on the Real Housewives of New Jersey.
All right.
Cause you gotta give me some reason to keep going.
This is not a show that I believe is stale, but I went with anyways because it tickled me. So my show is What We Do in the Shadows. And my suggestion is that we bring in Nandor's grandma, Grandor, I guess. And the thing is that she Nandora comes back. And I think the origin story is that she like was the first of the family to become a vampire. And it was one of those generational things where her son was a disappointment, but she saw everything in her grandson that her husband was, you know, blah, 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 you know, a really tough guy. Kind of like, you know, the mafia story where it skips a generation, that kind of thing. So grandma wants Nandor to reconnect with his bloodthirsty conqueror side. So she returns and comes into the house and like really just whips the house as a living unit into shape, developing efficiencies, fostering a sense of vampire patriotism or whatever that phrase would be. That sort of pushes the group as a whole towards their original goal of conquering Staten Island and the rest of the continent. But then, of course, after a few episodes, she is slain by Guillermo, but everyone just sort of like after the initial shock lets it slide because, frankly, all the stuff that they've been doing under grandma's new leadership was a lot of work. So they're happy to be sort of given permission to be lazy again.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like old grandma energy actresses.
I was thinking like Shore Agdashloo because he's Persian.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, oh, my
that's
God.
True.
Yes.
That's
a very
good point. Or Hiam Abbas from Succession.
So, yeah. So
she would also be sexy. And then like Laszlo would try and fuck her.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's your B story. Absolutely. So, yeah. So what we do in the shadows, Grandor comes and mixes
Sold.
Things up.
Or Nanador.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon, presenting this week, Mr. Mark Blankenship. Take it away, Mark.
Hello. I mean, it's not like I just got here, but, you know. So I have had the good fortune in my relationship with Extra Hot Great to bring many episodes of many television series to the canon, and I decided to take a bit of a left turn this time because I wanted to talk about an episode of a show that got, I think, frankly, very little attention when it was initially aired, or at least it's safe to say it has grown in stature the further away we've gotten from its original airing. And that is season 4, episode 7 of the show Dinosaurs, which was part of the ABC TGIF lineup in the 90s and starred a bunch of animatronic dinosaur puppets created by the Muppet folks, Jessica Walters, Sally Struthers, Sherman Hemsley, Michael McKean. A lot of these folks were the voices of these dinosaurs. And it was kind of like the Honeymooners, but with dinosaur puppets. But as the show went on, it sort of branched into two things simultaneously. One was that there was the baby puppet that became very popular with children, and it would kept screaming, "Not the mama!" And it would hit people in the head. You know, baby violence. Who doesn't love it? And then it also, as it wound down, took on more and more political issues. And it was able to tackle those issues pretty directly because it was always putting them through the prism of being told by dinosaurs. So you had a satirical veneer on top of everything that you were able to say. This leads us to the episode I've brought in today called Changing Nature, which is the final episode of the series. And it was the final episode that was aired on ABC. Seven other episodes were later aired in syndication, but for our purposes, let's consider it the final episode of Dinosaurs. And the premise of the show is that this is supposed to be the time of year when a swarm of bunch beetles are coming back to eat up all of the poppies that are growing up throughout Pangaea. And this is a crucial ritual that happens every year, and it's crucial because it means that the poppies stop choking up everything around, and also it's pretty because they are pretty to look at, these bunch beetles. So everyone is watching the news. There's newscasters who are counting down until they're supposed to arrive, and then the bunch beetles don't come. And this is what we hear from the brilliantly named Dino news anchor Howard Handupme.
"And so throughout the nation, anyone with even the least awareness of the world around them is asking, what happened to the bugs?
What happened to my beer? I set it right down here and... Oh, there it is."
So that is Earl, the patriarch of the dinosaur family, and he is immediately being set up as someone who is clueless about the consequences of environmental catastrophe. And this is the role he's been playing throughout the whole series. He's the meathead dad. I mean, it's not like the meathead dad has gone anywhere as a TV trope. So he is comically set up here to be like, "I don't notice what's going on. I just want my beer." And he's also set up in this scene as someone who loves technology, who thinks the technology is more important than the environment. All of these things are played for laughs at the beginning. And eventually, his daughter, who again is voiced by Sally Struthers and is named Charlene, clocks that the bunch beetles have not come back because their mating ground, which was a swamp, was destroyed, so that the brilliantly named We Say So Corporation could create a factory that sells wax fruit. So Charlene goes on TV in the very Lisa Simpson way that she inhabits, in the very Lisa Simpson persona that she inhabits on the show. She goes on the news and starts talking about how the environment is being destroyed because people wanted to make wax fruit. And Earl can't handle it. She's broadcasting from the kitchen. And so he barges in to set her straight and to demonstrate why her line of thinking is wrong and that it's actually okay to ruin the bunch beetle's habitat.
"We destroyed their mating ground and annihilated an entire species.
All gone.
And for what?
What?
Wax fruit.
What? Hey, 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 wax fruit's important. The ability to manufacture wax fruit is what separates us from the animals. She is talking about things she does not understand. She is
attention! We're out of my way!
What we have here is progress for progress's sake.
Hold on! You see, hold on! Hey, wait! I want to say something here!
Daddy! Huh? They're interviewing me!
Oh, yeah? Well, it's time for a responsible opposing viewpoint.
What?
You're full of it!
Oh!
Progress is good! It's progress that put electricity in the toothbrush! Progress put potato chips in a tennis ball can!
Sure,
some sacrifices had to be made along the way.
Great.
A forest here, a few species there. But in the end, wouldn't you trade all that for great advancements microwave toast? Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, you want to talk about progress? This takes all the guesswork out of making toast.
And that self-satisfied dummy laughter that Earl enjoys after he talks about microwave toast is in most shows the point where he would go back to being a harmless character. Homer Simpson doesn't really make that much havoc in the world, or at least it's havoc that can be fixed. But this is also the moment where this episode starts to shift into something darker, because Earl says this on television, and lots of people see him, and suddenly the Lisa Simpson voice of reason character, as embodied by Charlene, starts to lose ground. And Earl, the blinkered fool who doesn't want to pay attention to any consequences, starts to gain power. And then he becomes a patsy and a puppet of the We Say So Corporation, because they need someone to lead a, quote, task force to convince the world that everything that's happening is just fine. So when they decide that they're going to spray chemicals all over the cider poppies and kill them all, they get old Earl out there to plead their case to the media. And here's how that goes.
Mr. Sinclair, isn't the word defoliant just another name for poison?
Poison is such a harsh word. We on the task force prefer to think of it as botanical bye-bye juice.
Oh, yeah.
Just where does this bye-bye juice come from?
It was graciously made available to us by a concerned industrialist who stands behind us 1,000%.
And who would that be?
Oh, that would be
He prefers to remain anonymous.
So this is the point where Earl is starting to get a little bit better at putting spin on his conservative values. And that even starts to carry over to his family. After the poison kills all of the plant life on Earth, and not just the poppies, this is how he talks about it to his family.
Maybe we went a little overboard with the poison.
A little? Your stupid spray killed all plant life.
Hey, what are you complaining about? You never liked salads anyway.
You destroyed the global food chain. No plants means no food at all.
Nonsense. There's a wide variety of commercial snack foods that have virtually no natural ingredients.
Earl, we can't live on ho-hos.
I can.
So that's the baby making a typical sitcom joke in the midst of the mounting horror that the world has been destroyed. And in this moment, the show has really shifted into something else, where the yearning for sitcom rhythms is starting to be weaponized against us, the audience, that the clinging to jokes with easy beats starts to feel dangerous and starts to make us, by implication, more like Earl, if we want the baby to make a joke right there, because it's an easy escape to get away from what is happening. And the moralizing of the episode continues apace as we start to see that the world is getting destroyed. And it's at this point good to remember that this show was ostensibly geared toward children. So there are some very clear underlines of what people are doing, what they're up to, what they're supposed to represent. But it also gives us an excellent opportunity to enjoy some voiceover acting, like this moment from Sherman Hemsley when he is playing one of the dino overlords of the We Say So Corporation.
I think you're missing the point, sir. The world may be coming to an end.
Well, that's a fourth quarter problem. We'll drop a bomb on that bridge when we come to it. Right now, my biggest problem is trying to figure out what to do with all this money.
And Sherman's dinosaur there doesn't give a fuck about dead plants, because everybody's now buying We Say So products. to help them stay warm now that an ice age is clearly starting to take over the world in the absence of plant life. And then, unlike every other sitcom ever, nothing improves. And what happens instead is that snow starts to fall. We learn that there is not going to be any more sunlight on the planet for thousands of years. Earl has to acknowledge that he screwed up. And then he makes this hopeful statement that, well, you know, dinosaurs have been around for millions of years. Surely nothing will happen to us. And then they watch the snow fall. And then, just in case you think that he was right to feel hope, this is what we hear in the very last moment of the show from our news anchor.
And taking a look at the long-range forecast, continued snow, darkness, and extreme cold. This is Howard Handupme. Good night. Goodbye.
And there we have the end of a children's show about puppets. The entire world is destroyed through the hubris of dino kind. The parallels to humanity are very obvious, but my argument for this show or this episode's worthiness for canonization stems from the fact that in 1994, when it originally aired, it was such a bold move for a family sitcom to be this bleak and this unsparing in its environmental and social critique. And the echo effect of this episode can still be felt today. It is still talked about online. And it is astonishing to think that this came on during TGIF, when like fucking Family Matters and Step by Step were coming on as well. So this episode, I'm not going to pretend, is necessarily full of groundbreaking jokes. There are very much a lot of familiar rhythms, but I think that its courage and its convictions makes it worth considering.
Okay. Sarah, wow. Why don't you start us off?
Yikes. All right. Well, this dinosaur will begin. I had heard of dinosaurs, but had never seen a frame of it. And having seen the absolute swing for the fences that this episode is, I think I'm all set. I can't believe this. I can't believe this aired during TGIF. I almost can't believe this aired at all. This is a fucking snuff film. Like, there's this moment where he's explaining, like, okay, well, you know, I'm not sure what the world is going to look like, or something that could be misinterpreted. And the baby's like, so are we going to move? And the whole family's like, And I was like, I can't believe they went there. And then there's this very peaceful snowfall that's like, oh, well, this is sort of pretty. And maybe it's just like Fraggle Rock and it'll be okay. Like, you know, it's not going to be okay. You know what happened to the dinosaurs. And then there's Howard Hand Up Me being like, well, goodbye. I mean, I'm trying to imagine what it would have been like to see this as like an 8-year-old and just like not sleep for 3 weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
Kind of high strung as a kid, but this is absolutely what my response would have been. So on the basis of this being bonkers, but also extremely relevant to today, and peopled with, like, I was the one who watched not necessarily the news, so the guy who voices Earl, Stuart Pankin, is that guy. Jessica Walter, what's his name? McMurray is in this too, I think. So there's another Simpsons connection, I think. Or Tracy Ullman connection to the Simpsons. I mean, this was really, I was like, where is this going? And then I started to see where it was going, and then I Googled the episode and was like, geez. So I think this might be one of those episodes that, like, on the basis of quality, maybe not, but on the basis of historical significance, attention must be paid. But I am interested to hear what my fellow panelists think, Tara and or Dave.
I'll go next. I mean, I can certainly appreciate that, like, the slight difference between, like, the half a generation difference between me and Mark is causing a lot of different reaction between me and Mark on this. I mean, I probably didn't watch this when it aired. This show was not my jam. I'm sure I saw some of it because my sister was, you know, a lot younger than me, and this would have been for her. You know, there are things to appreciate about it. I certainly like that there's no sugarcoating, that capitalism is the villain here. It's pretty clear about that without actually using the word, you know, saying that worrying about how to spend all this money or what to do with it is, you know, a third quarter problem. And if your world ends in the fourth quarter, like, we'll worry. We'll drop a bridge on it then. Got it. don't really get where they were going with the lone beetle that does survive hitting on the daughter. That was weird.
Yeah, that was weird.
And also, like, when there was a reference to the spotted...
Last chance to get some, Tara.
I guess. Anyway.
He doesn't know that.
The spotted owl reference was, you know, that was a blast from the past of like past culture war issues. But, you know, considering that we're in a time when, you know, people are saying that like the crisis that we're currently living through is sort of a dress rehearsal for climate change when it gets really bad. Like, this was not necessarily what I wanted to watch right now. The greater issue for me is that, like, it's the same thing that we were saying, or that I said with regard to Father Brown a couple of weeks ago, which is, would we vote any other episode of Dinosaurs into the canon? I guess that was not the same thing because that was a known act. But, I mean, I get where you're going with this. I can understand that this was for you and for people in your generation. Like, at the time, it hit you in a certain way, and it, like, imprinted on you, and it's still, like, the scar remains, but I can't go back to that place with you. I can't be that age watching it for the first time. And as much as I appreciate like the ambition and the chutzpah that it took to air this on ABC, like, it's not good. Dave.
Yeah, it's bold, but it's terrible. That's the problem of it. If it was bold and well done, that would be something. Like, you could appreciate the fact that at some point somebody said, well, we got a show about dinosaurs. How are we going to end this? Duh. We're going to get canceled. Let's do it. I admired that part of it. I admire the fact that they did it and somehow they got the network to air it. Like, that's kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
But the manner in which the episode is written is not nuanced. It is just like a what the fuck kind of feeling to it. It doesn't feel poignant or anything like that. It just feels like they invited you to a dinner party at their house and they answered at the door in a tie and nothing else, and they just pretend nothing's wrong. Like, it's just like weird, and it just puts you off balance, but it's not like really well written or anything of that sort. And I think that's where it is. It kind of reminded me of this show we talked about like last year when we were doing something about TV finales, and I wish I could remember the name of the show, but basically they knew we were going to get canceled. So like the end of the last episode is like all the characters just breaking the wall and saying, well, the network just canceled us. And like
Cop Rock. It's Cop Rock.
No, it's not Cop Rock. It's a sitcom.
I mean, it also is
like
Cop
the
Rock.
Father announces something and they come in and like the crew starts disassembling the set and everything. You know, the camera pulls back to show that it's a TV show and all that kind of stuff.
Oh,
and, like,
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think it's got She's in the title, but I don't know. Anyways, but it kind of reminds me of that. Like, oh, that was really interesting way to go in a blaze of glory. It wasn't particularly well done, but I admire the fact that they did it. And that's where I am with this. Speaking of some weird things, I don't quite understand the dinosaurs universe at times, because at the beginning of the episode, he is working his grill, his barbecue grill, and it is a grill that you could just walk into a Home Depot and buy. And then on the other side of the grill, on the table, is a rock framed TV, like out of the Flintstones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So some things are made of rock and prehistoric, but the things you could just pick up at Lowe's or whatever, apparently.
Also, Charlene's boyfriend has a varsity jacket, socks, and sneakers. No pants.
That's her brother.
Yeah, that's his brother. And then where did he get the floppy horns from?
Yeah.
So I think there's a dinosaur milkman situation going on.
Shouldn't
here
they all be the same species? I mean, these are stupid nitpicks, but pants, Mr. Dinosaur.
Why are you wearing socks and shoes, but no pants?
It's weird.
Question I've been asked more than once.
Yeah, Mark didn't really get into it, but the scene just before the last news broadcast where the family is just tiptoeing around the baby's questions. So fucked
cheesy
up. And also, what's the baby? What is the baby here? The baby's like a triceratops before he gets his horns. Like, I don't know what's going on with this family. Anyways, I put on Instagram, this was one hell of a swing for the fences argument coming your way. It was a great swing for the fences, Mark. I just wish that show could have backed you up with some quality writing and execution, which I don't think it did. So with that, let's throw it to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah, it was bad, but I think it was important, so I'm going to vote yes.
Tara Ariana.
I admire your chutzpah as well, Mark, but I'm going to vote no.
I'm going to vote no as well. So, unfortunately, that means that... Dinosaurs. Season 4, Episode 7. Changing Nature. You were hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Creek.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has the winner.
I do. It is various sports narratives. First of all, Last Chance U, which I've talked about many times on this here podcast, is debuting its final season on Netflix at the end of this month. But the good news is that it is transitioning in some way into a new related franchise that will be about college hoops, which is great for me and fans of basketball. But everyone should watch the show. It's really not that much about sports. The other thing is that Colin Kaepernick is soon to be the subject of a scripted drama series from Ava DuVernay at Netflix. I am super excited for this. I almost wish that she would do a documentary because he's extremely charismatic. But, I mean, maybe she can do it. She could do it both. Like a pastiche. Not a pastiche. Collage. Like the Transy Art Heist movie. Anyway, I'm excited to watch it, whatever comes out, because she's awesome.
Loser of the week.
Well, NBC had a big hit in its scripted drama with This Is Us. And then they tried to do it again in a musical form with Rise, and that didn't work. And then they tried to do it again in New York with a show called The Village, and that didn't work.
Oh, yeah, The Village,
And then they tried to do it again this year with Council of Dads, and that has become the latest NBC attempt to clone This Is Us to get canceled after one season. R.I.P. Council of Dads.
What if the This Is Us family, the Conrads, I don't know, what are they?
I don't even remember. It's been 2 months.
So the Conrads, let's say, are sort of the curse family, and every other generation working backwards in the Conrads, the father dies in a really horrific way and it affects the family in this way. And they just do, like, instead of the next generation, it's like, this was us. And then it's like,
well, there's your new Penny Dreadful right there. Penny Dreadful. This was us.
R.I.P. Conrad's hamsters. Sure.
Speaking of dreadful,
speaking of dreadful and dead hamsters, you know what time it is?
Cape time.
This is the ninth game time of the season. The season scores are Sarah 3 points, Tara 3 points, value guess 2 points, close season. Today we are playing Nobody Knows You from David Ellis Dickerson, who earns himself an extra credit. Topic: who are TV's least memorable characters, and who are TV's least memorable actors, according to the masses? Today we find out. We actually have a pretty good idea of the answers because of the quiz-based website Sporacle.
This is
what Dave did. He scoured Sporacle for quizzes about identifying TV characters and TV actors from certain shows.
Okay.
Whoever was at the bottom of those lists is what you need to answer today.
Yes. Okay.
So, for example, you're going to identify the character or actor least commonly identified in the relevant quiz for something like can you name these Breaking Bad actors or
okay.
characters?
Okay,
right. Gotcha.
I'll give you the quiz subject matter. You tell me what the least recognized actor or character was.
Okay.
Each of these quizzes had at least 1,000 responses and sometimes dozens of thousands of responses. So don't blame me or Dave if you disagree.
Family Feud rules apply. We understand.
Yes, got it.
All right, so let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. Oh. Mark, Sarah, Tara, 30 questions, 2 equalizer challenge zones from Mr. Grossworth. Are we ready to play Nobody Knows You?
Yes.
All right. Mark Blankenship, your first category is Friends characters. All right. So the main cast of Friends characters. Who is the least identified Friends character? And the way these quizzes work is they give you pictures of the characters and you have to click who's this, who's that. So who was the least identified character from Friends?
Just like the 6 of them?
Yes.
Or are we talking about extended world?
I said the lead characters.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Chandler.
From Friends. A sitcom on NBC. Kind of popular.
Man, but who would it be?
I'm going to guess Matthew Perry as Chandler.
All right. Chandler is your answer?
Yes.
Incorrect. This is how the game works now. We go to the next person in line down the line to see
if they
can guess. We go from Mark to Sarah. Sarah, Mark got it wrong, so now it falls to you to guess who is the least identified Friends character.
Huh. I'm going to say Schwimmer.
A character.
Character, Ross.
Incorrect to Tara.
Phoebe?
Phoebe is correct. That would have been the end of the line.
Phoebe.
So everybody could get up to one guess on things. So Tara gets that point. Now to Sarah. Least identified Friend actor. Same gist, the main actors. We're talking actors.
Oh, okay. I'm going to say Schwimmer again.
To Tara.
Whose name is least known? Matt LeBlanc.
Mark.
Okay. I'm going to just go with the same masses taking the same quizzes and say Lisa Kudrow. Damn.
Your answer was Courtney Cox.
Really?
Really?
Oh. That is surprising.
Tara, here's your first.
Okay.
Beverly Hills 90210 actor-character combination, so what character and actor from the first 4 seasons was the least identified?
Least identified from the first...
So you can give me the actor or the character. It's the same.
4 seasons. Okay. Are the parents included? I guess you can't give me that information.
I would say that we're talking...
Opening credits
cast.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say James Eckhouse.
Okay. Who played Mr. Walsh?
Played Mr. Jim
Walsh.
That
is a good guess.
Okay, that was incorrect. So we now go to Mark.
Wasn't that kid Scott in the opening credits?
Dead Scott. Was he?
He for some of it.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Not right.
Okay.
That's who I would have guessed. Least identified, and it's not Dead Scott.
From the first 4 seasons.
Carteris.
Correct.
Wow, oh, nice.
Andrea Zuckerman / Gabriel Carteris is the correct answer. Back to Mark. Least identified Modern Family adult character.
Okay. Do I have to know the name of the character to be able to play?
Correct.
Or can I name the actor and assume that it's that I'm talking about the character? I think I can get it. Okay, I think I can get it. The least identified character.
I mean, I'll allow it.
But it's the least identified adult character.
Yes.
I'm going to say Jay.
Jay. Incorrect to Sarah.
Phil.
That's what I was going to say.
Only name I could come up with.
Mitchell? Fuck.
Haley.
Who?
Haley.
Haley.
But she's not an adult.
She's a kid.
She's a kid.
Oh, I guess she crossed over to being an adult at some point.
Yeah.
All right. Ooh.
Sarah DeBunching, designing women actors from Designing Women.
Actors.
Least identified actor from Designing Women.
Least identified actor.
So Designing Women actors, they're referring to the Designing Women of Designing Women.
Right. Right. Okay. So not the designing,
not the guy,
man,
yeah,
who sometimes came in. Mm. Okay. Least actor.
That episode got into the canon when I brought it up. Damn it.
Yeah. Well, they didn't all, you know, die in a nuclear winter and design women, did they?
didn't they? I. Oh God.
Hot color of the year, gray.
I think it's Shit.
I think it's time for an answer. Let's go.
Yeah, so do I. I can't pull this other person's name, so Delta Burke.
Incorrect to Tara.
Annie Potts.
Incorrect.
Shit.
To Mark.
Meshach Taylor.
The least identified actor was Jean Smart.
Oh, did you specify that it was supposed to be one of the women that we guessed?
Yes, like three times. Jesus.
Designing women characters
from Designing Women.
Okay. Characters. I mean, I guess I'll play the odds and say Charlene.
Charlene is not the right answer. To Mark.
I'll say Mary Jo.
Mary Jo is our correct answer.
Nice.
That's good for a point.
We are all tied up.
Very good. Mark, get first crack at this one. Mary Tyler Moore show characters from season one, and remind you, that's where she had a roommate, a neighbor, and three co-workers, basically.
Okay, I'm going to have to use the actors' names. I've never seen a single episode
that's
of this
fine.
Show. Okay. I am going to say Cloris Leachman's character.
Phyllis is correct.
Wow. Nice. Oh, one.
Yes.
Sarah DeBunting.
Yeah.
Mary Tyler Moore show actors from season one, least identified by the masses. Shown
by
the picture,
the
couldn't match the name.
I think it's Gavin McLeod.
You are correct.
Oh, that's what I would have said. Good job.
Tara.
Yeah.
Facts of life characters.
Characters.
Oh,
you take the good.
You take the bad.
Right.
Yeah, you take them all. Mm-hmm. And you have your answer.
Natalie.
Correct.
Well done.
Nice. That's what I would have guessed.
And Mark, facts of life actors.
I have to go with Mindy Cohn.
That's not correct.
Whoa.
To Sarah. Fact of life actor, least identified.
Least identified. Lisa Welchel.
Correct.
Yes, God, I should have said that. Yes, good, good, good.
Wow. Sarah DeBunting, you get first crack at this. Buffy season two main characters. So that's including Angel and Spike, but not Drusilla and Oz.
Characters.
Correct.
Not actors. Okay. Cordelia Chase.
Wow.
Nicely done.
She's on a roll.
All right, Tara, before our first score break, you answer this one.
Mm-hmm.
Buffy season two actors least identified by photo.
God.
Season two main actors from Buffy. This one.
Yeah.
Least identified by sporical citizens.
Anthony Stewart Head. Damn it.
Incorrect. So we move to Mark for an answer.
Was Charisma Carpenter on the show at this time?
Yeah, that's who played Cordelia Chase.
Yeah, okay, that's how I pick her.
Incorrect. Can Sarah pick up another Buffy point?
Shit. I don't know. I'm surprised it was not Tony Head, but I will guess Nicholas Brendon.
You are correct.
Damn!
Wow. Nicely done.
Sarah
All right.
is running away with this game.
Scores, please, Tara.
Sarah is running away with this game.
Oh.
With 5 points. Mark and I are tied with 2 points each.
All right, we're not quite at halfway yet, so there's still plenty of game to be played.
Okay.
But you're tied, so that means you are both in
the collaborative's equalizer zone.
You are correct. So collaborate on your answers. If you get three right, you will split your 2 points, 1 point each.
Got it.
Classics.
Yep.
What 1950 show was the first dramatic series to star a black actress?
Dramatic series.
Dramatic series. 1950, the year.
I do not know.
Mark? Wasn't the show, was the show Hazel a comedy or a drama?
I think it was a comedy.
Beulah.
Nope.
No, it's never happening. Okay.
Sitcoms. Who's the dim-witted caretaker of the Stratford Inn on Newhart?
Oh, no. What's his name?
Oh, God.
I will accept first or last name for this one.
Is it the guy who had a brother Earl and another brother Earl?
No,
or is
no,
that...
it's the guy who was married to Valerie Suzanne or Suzanne Plachet. I don't know. He's in the overalls, but I don't remember the character's name.
Lyle.
Sure.
George Utley.
Oh, George.
What was his name? Tom Poston?
Tom Poston,
sure. Oh, yeah.
Drama. What Dallas character's maiden name was Shepherd?
I don't even remember the mom's name anymore. It's so bad. Should I guess JR's wife? That's the only one I know.
Sure, go for it.
Was her name Suzanne? Suzanne.
Sue Ellen.
Oh, shit.
Founder of Housing.
We're all rooting for you. Kids and games. You need all three.
We need all three of these, Mark.
Okay.
What was Concentration called when it returned to TV after a 14-year absence?
Classic Concentration. I know that for a fact.
Thank God. Good job,
nice.
Mark.
Stars. What Barney Miller regular died in 1978, leaving a void in coffee jokes?
Jesus.
I can only think of who it wasn't.
Was it Abe Vigoda?
No, he was still alive in like the 2000s.
Yeah.
It wasn't Robert Guillaume.
No.
Definitely.
No.
I
only remember who was alive, so this I got nothing.
Jack Sue.
Nope.
S-O-O.
Never, ever going to happen.
I knew the guy. I just couldn't pull the name.
It's too bad you couldn't get that one, because your next question in the wild card was, what British comedy series starred John Cleese, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, among others? Close, but no cigar, so no points for
Mark.
You two.
That was a tough card.
Yeah.
So we're back into the game. Mark, you're up.
Yes.
Least identified first names of teen characters from Saved by the Bell.
Oh,
teen characters. Don't be saying Mr. Belding this time, Mark.
I know. Dave could not have made it clearer, but clearly I just wanted to talk about Meshach Taylor
the
today,
designing
so.
Women of Saved by the Bell.
Alice Ghostly. No, that's not my answer.
All right, so first names of teen characters from Saved by the Bell were presented. They tried to match into faces. Couldn't do it for this guy most of the time.
And we're talking about characters. I'm going to say AC, as in AC Slater.
Correct. You're welcome for my bonus hint that I let slip. Sarah D. Bunting. Crew members from The Love Boat, seasons 1 to 6. The hint here is Ted McGinley, show killer, not in the show until season 7.
Yeah.
I say with authority, like I've seen one episode of Lifeboat.
So crew members is so the character name.
I've watched so many episodes, I've called it Lifeboat.
Lifeboat.
I assume that also means like the daughter's not in the running.
Crew members. So.
Yeah. Fucking Vicky. The doctor. Doc.
The doctor. Oh, okay. No. Sorry. I was just reading some extra information I will give to you at the end. Okay, Tara.
Oh, God, what was her name? This the lady with the Dorothy Hamill haircut, whose name was possibly Lauren.
All right, Mark. Last crack at the lifeboat question.
Mm. Oh, hell, gopher.
Gopher is incorrect. The correct answer was Ted Lang as bartender Isaac Washington, who was 0.6% less than the doc that was
Whoa.
There.
Whoa.
You're practically right, but not points right.
Isaac.
The Belchers on Bob's Burgers.
Gene.
Gene is correct. Said with authority.
Nice.
Tight game, though. 92.6 correct, 0.1% below Louise. Mm. So everybody knew most of them, but it was a game of inches. Mark Blankenship. Characters from season one of Lost who are still visibly around by the end of season three.
Oh, wow. This is deep. Layers upon layers.
Yeah. Characters.
Okay, I'm going to guess Claire.
Oh, nice.
Whoa.
Oh. Wow.
Nicely done.
Yes.
Oh, Sarah. Arrested Development characters. So the main cast of Arrested Development characters. The main slate of Arrested Development characters, rather.
God. The hell is his name? Shit. There's so many arguments for all of them, George Michael.
Tara.
Tobias. Shit.
Mark.
Oh.
Lindsay.
Wow.
Whoa.
Nice.
Correct.
Here comes Mark.
Well, right, I guess it's those anonymous blondes helping me out.
Arrested Development actors.
Okay.
Same shtick. Main folks.
Jeffrey Tambor.
Mark.
Tony Hale.
Sarah.
I like that guess.
Jessica Walter.
Leah Shawkat. Not Cat Shaw, as I might have said in an edited thing, which why bother editing it if I just admitted it? Complicated man. Played on head smash. Mark Blankenship. West Wing actors from the season two credits.
Janelle Maloney.
Correct.
Yes. Damn.
Wow.
Another anonymous blonde.
Characters. Sarah D. Bunding. West Wing characters appearing in the season two credits.
Characters. Toby.
Correct.
Wow.
Bit of interesting trivia. Donna was the most guessed character.
Hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, interesting. But the least guessed actor. Tara.
Yep.
Characters from The Good Place season one.
Jason.
Good guess.
To Mark.
Michael.
To Sarah.
Chidi?
Tahani was the least remembered at 88.7, slightly ahead of Eleanor at 91.
Really?
Yeah. Mark Blankenship.
Yes.
The Golden Girls of Golden
Not
Girls.
Stan.
Characters, all right? The Golden Girls.
Characters.
Of the Golden Girls.
Yes, so I'm going to guess Carl Reiner. No way, no.
R.I.P.
It's hard to imagine not knowing all four of them. Why would you play this game otherwise? Okay. But I'm going to guess Sophia. Yes!
77.7 out of 30,000 guesses.
Wow, damn.
Sarah D. Bunting? Scooby-Doo characters. Jesus Least Christ. Identified Scooby-Doo character.
Fred.
What? I was nodding so sagely.
Tara.
God. Daphne? Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. That's what I should have said.
Yeah.
I was sure you were right.
Fred, the number one identified character.
Fuck off.
Oh,
97.3%.
What? Who played this game? The fucking kerchief lobby?
Oh, Sporkle people. All right. I don't know anything about them. Don't want to know anything about them.
Big V-neck.
Take us into our second score break.
Okay.
Star Trek Next Generation Bridge Crew, not counting Tasha Yar. Not counting Tasha Yar.
Okay. So that also doesn't count Beverly Crusher. She's not on the bridge.
Yes, correct.
Okay. Geordi?
Okay. He's also not bridge crew, but...
He's not?
It's engineering.
Oh. He's not?
Okay.
No, he's an engineering...
But didn't he sit up there in the front with his little visor on?
Yeah. In the Chekhov spot.
He was he was filling. He was seat warming sometimes, I think.
He's not the right
He was the chief engineer. His business was in the engineering department.
That's true.
I wouldn't
Let's argue about this.
Give me some time. I'm fine to do it, actually. Yes, he was up there a lot, but I don't think he would... I don't know what Sporkle's thinking, guys. But to me, he would not be bridge crew.
Okay.
But, you know, okay. I choose to be pedantic.
It passes to Mark.
Okay, I'm Mark. Going to guess.
Meshach Taylor.
It's character name.
Bridge crew. Yeah.
I'm going to guess Worf.
All right, Sarah. Can you get it?
I mean, look, he served me well in the past, so I'm going to say Riker.
Troy, Counselor Troy.
Troy. Why does she even have a seat?
Why is she on the bridge?
You said Tasha Yar was excluded. Okay. What the fuck is she doing on the bridge?
Feeling when you're angry about questions.
Ordering a goddamn chocolate sundae.
I'm sensing
sundae
anger
from
the contestants.
Camel toe advisory board.
Still a very close game. Mark has 7 points. Sarah has 6 points. I have 4 points.
All right. So, Tara, guess what? You are in the... Grossworth equalizer. Shelza?
Alone.
The bunker!
Wow, wow. All right, here we go. Classics.
Yep.
What actor played Buddy Sorrell, a TV writer with a wife named Pickles on the Dick Van Dyke Show? What actor played Buddy Sorrell on the Dick Van Dyke Show? Apparently had a wife named Pickles.
Yeah.
Or given name? Who knows?
Don't know.
Maury Amsterdam.
Right.
Sitcoms.
Yep.
What does WKRP DJ Venus Flytrap's birth certificate say his name is?
I don't know. I look forward to finding out.
Gordon Sims.
Aw, Gordon.
Drama.
Gordo.
Yep.
How many consecutive nights were needed to air Roots?
Six?
Eight.
Dear.
All right.
Wow.
Gotta get all of these.
Okay.
What quiz/comedy show opened and closed to the tune of Hooray for Captain Spaulding?
Oh, no.
Hooray for Captain Spaulding!
What
That's
was the
not
first
song
part of the question?
At all.
What is?
Quiz/comedy show.
You bet your life.
Great.
Nice.
Damn. Stars. Well done.
What director added mystery to 4 black and white Calvin Klein obsession ads? What director added mystery to 4 black and white Calvin Klein obsession ads?
Joel Schumacher? Shit.
R.I.P. David Lynch.
Oh.
David Lynch.
Oh. I like that Schumacher guess, though.
Which had the...
Seems like he should have, right?
Which had the larger pay-per-view audience in 1989? Tyson Spinks fight or WrestleMania 4?
Tyson.
No.
Damn.
WrestleMania 4.
Yeah.
Cards are against me.
All right, everybody's got 2 questions left.
Okay.
Mark.
All right.
Who was the least identified character from How I Met Your Mother? Title sequence characters.
Allison Hannigan's character.
Allison Hannigan's character. Who was what?
Lily.
No, sorry.
Oh.
You're correct in saying Lily. Mark was incorrect saying that. Good save, Dave. All right. Sarah.
Same question?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know character names, so Jason Segel's character?
Marshall.
Marshall.
Correct.
Thank you. Sorry.
Sarah D. Bunting, here's your actual first crack question. Actor from How I Met Your Mother. Actor. Least actor. Identified actor.
Bottom of the barrel.
I'm torn between the two actors already. But I think it's whoever plays the guy, Ted something? Mosby?
Correct. Josh
Radnor.
Radnor. Tara.
Yeah.
Women from Sex and the City. The women from Sex and the City. The Sex and the Cities of Sex and the City.
Mario Cantone. Just kidding.
Designing on you of Sex and the City.
Golden Lee.
Okay. Least identified actors.
No.
No?
Women.
Character.
Of Sex and the City.
Characters. Oh, the characters. Okay. Then I'm going to say Charlotte.
Correct.
Yes.
Yep.
Mark, your last question.
Everyone's like, that's correct.
Actually, yeah. Quickly, scores, please.
Okay, I am in dead last place. No chance of winning. 5 points. Uh-huh. Mark has 7 points. Sarah has 8 points.
Oh, my God.
You have a chance of tying, in theory, so...
No, I don't.
There's 3 points you could get here.
Oh, okay.
You can answer each one of these correctly somehow.
Oh, right, okay.
So mathematically, sure. You're still in it. Brackets,
not
you're not.
Likely.
Mark Blankenship.
Narrator, nah.
Guys the women wind up with in Sex and the City. Mm. Least identified. Character. Guys the women end up with in Sex and the City. We're talking about the character.
Sadly, Meshach Taylor, not a cast member of Sex and the City. I'm going to say, Jared.
Pardon me?
Smith Jared.
What?
Nice.
I had information on whose man that was, but you didn't need it. That was Samantha's dude, Smith.
Sure was. Also of 90210.
Yep.
All right, Sarah, first crack at characters in the community study group, least identified.
Least identified. Oh, fuck. Abed.
Incorrect. Tara.
Shirley.
Correct. 81%. 81. Pierce, 87.
I wanted it to be Pierce. I think we all did.
Yeah, me too. But we all said, you know. Life's not good like that.
Your last question.
Yep.
Opening credits characters... from Deadwood, All Seasons. Anybody? Any character from an actor who has been on the opening credits of Deadwood?
Dan Doherty.
Correct. To Mark.
I'm going to have to give you an actor's name again.
Yeah.
Anna Gunn's character.
Trixie. Oh, no.
No, that's Mrs. Wife. Bullock.
Yeah, Mrs. Yeah. Bullock. And her name is Anna, right? Isn't it Anna Bullock?
I don't know. I forget. It's been a while. Let's say yes, but I don't think it's right. Martha?
Yes, you're right.
Martha, yeah. Sarah.
Least identified character from the opening credits.
Yeah.
Fuck. Saul Star.
Incorrect. Jim Beaver was on the opening credits for a little bit.
Oh. Or
Ellsworth.
Ellsworth.
Beaver. All right, that is regulation, so final scores, please. Tara?
Well, I have 6 points. Mm-hmm. Mark and Sarah. Talk about a tie. Ooh. 8 points each.
Missed it.
Sorry, 8 points each. Coming into this, value guess we're behind. So value guess will get first crack at our tiebreaker question.
Click.
Oh.
That is this. Least identified character ever listed in the credits of Cheers. So if the actor was listed in the credit of Cheers... this character.
Ever at any time across
any season,
all million seasons.
Any season of Cheers, opening credit character. Mark,
okay,
you have
y'all.
First crack.
I'm going to say Coach.
Damn. Coach is not correct. Sarah.
Coach would have been my guess. Cliff Clavin.
Back to Mark.
Okay.
A little more information for you. 59.9%.
Oh, that's really so helpful. That just blows the lid off this 90, whole thing.
90,000 entries in this one.
Lilith.
That's what I would have guessed.
Not Correct. Back to Sarah.
The power of Xenu compels me to guess Rebecca.
Then it is Rebecca. Oh, yes. Yes.
Thank you, Xenu.
Thetans.
Sarah.
Indeed was. Nicely done, boy. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, well fought, everybody. That game was fun.
Yeah,
yes. That's good.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We spent our allotted stage time on the Will Ferrell take on Eurovision in Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, before going around the dial with stops at Search Party, Hot Mess House, Penny Dreadful, City of Angels, Unsolved Mysteries, and Outcry. Dave from Lost Wages asked us to go all in on the family, and Mark's Hannon argument for the apocalyptic capper of dinosaurs was iced out by the EHG gang.
Oh.
We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from David. Next up, Extra Extra Hot Greats, episode 69.
Nice.
And on the next two AHD primes, we got Forcening and Palm Springs. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tar Ariano,
Sporkle,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I can take maybe this much shit,
and Mark Blankenship,
Eurovision.
Thanks for listening. See you next. That was a real dinosaur of an end there. We'll see you next time right here on Extra.
Okay.
I can't take this shit. Okay?
Okay.
It's like this much shit.
I know.
I can maybe take this much shit, but it's up here.
It's a lot of shit.
Shit!